In today's world, there are now four ways a company can execute a workflow. You can do it the old-fashioned way by having a knowledge worker use traditional enterprise software, like having a support tech enter case data into a case management system. The second way you can do it is you now can have a knowledge worker leveraging AI. Let's say you have an education professional using Gen AI model to create education materials. The third way is you can now have AI agents engage directly with customers to complete tasks. So think of like an AI-enabled chatbot on a support portal. And finally, people now have AI completely automating workflows. Today, I will be conversing with the CEO of a technology company that is helping support organizations leverage AI to unlock these new types of workflows. I am Tom Saw, the Executive Director of the Technology and Services Industry Association. Welcome to Tectonic, the podcast where we explore what makes technology business models successful in today's world. And today, I will be joined by Krishna Raj Raja, the founder and CEO of Support Logic, a company that specializes in helping support organizations leverage AI to automate workflows. He is also the author of a book titled Support Experience: How Innovative Companies Use AI to Win the Hearts, Minds, and Wallets of Customers. So let's get the insight engine humming. Welcome, Krishna. It's nice to see you again. How long has Support Logic been around? And what was the catalyst for starting this company?
Support Logic was actually incorporated in 2016, but I would say the company came into existence in 2018. I incorporated the company. It was sabbatical for a year and a half. And then the company, I came into effect in 2018. The genesis for Support Logic is a story that I'm very fond of. I actually talk about this in my book as well. I used to do customer support for a company called VMware. I joined them when they were less than 100 people, such a small company.
Yeah.
They barely had any customer support. They didn't have weekend support. They had like email support. There was nothing enterprise support at the time, and only four support engineers. And I distinctly remember that we would have beer bash on Friday in Palo Alto.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And support cases will come in, we'll just ignore the queue and go and beer bash. That was the quality of support we had. But quickly, the company changed and it became well adopted and became an enterprise company, and the support and everything scaled. So when I joined, support was five people. And I think when I left the organization, it was close to 1,800 people or something to that extent.
Yeah.
So massive growth. In that growth period, I realized the importance of support. Mm-hmm. I realized the importance of understanding and listening to customers and what they say in the context of a support case. Because a lot of the stuff they say in the context of a support case has implications for a product team, has implications for sales teams, product marketing teams, product management teams. So my ears and eyes were wide open listening to those signals and in tandem in resolving the customer issues. And I would take those signals and I would go to different departments and channel those signals to those different departments. And I realized how inefficient this process was.
Yeah.
Basically, as a human being, listening to all the customer calls, reading through all the discussion forums, scouting all the signals we are finding, summarizing in our brain, creating intelligence, correlation between what the patterns I'm seeing. Then I'm educating the different functional groups. And I thought there must be a better way to do it. I thought, what if we make a system of intelligence that stays with the company, doesn't stay with people's brain, that continuously listens and monitors every customer interaction and provides us insights on an ongoing basis and basically convert those insights into workflows. So that's the genesis idea. That's what led to Support Logic.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's fantastic. And, you know, we've said for years that the support service organizations are an incredible conduit for telemetry and what's going on with the customer. And to the point that you made, fantastic signal liquidity for product teams, for marketing teams, for sales teams. And so what you're talking about is just making it a lot easier to share that signal liquidity. Now, I want to click into a particular topic around AI agents, because there's just so much buzz on this topic. I mean, for crying out loud, there's Super Bowl commercials about AI agents, all right? And so this thing is clearly hit mainstream. So what is the difference from your perspective right now between earlier generations of chatbots and what's going on today with AI agents? What's different there?
My perspective, it's all an evolution. This is not a revolution. I think people think it's a revolution because it's in the news and Super Bowl commercial. So we think it's a brand new stuff. But we've been working towards this direction for years, right? I mean, 20 years ago, we had expert systems. And expert systems completely were rules driven. So which means you have to write if then else conditions for, yep, I don't know, 500 different conditions, and then you act in a specific way. And clearly people realize that's not scalable for a lot of business challenges where the data actually has the rules, but can you infer the rules from the existing data? That is a fundamental idea of machine learning. So that's why it's called learning. You're learning from the data. The machine is learning from the existing data and inferring the expert system rules, right? So that's the first evolution. And again, machine learning has been around the block for quite some time. Mm-hmm. In fact, one of the angel investors in my company, I think she's in her 60s, and her PhD thesis was in natural language processing. This is, we're talking about 1980s time period.
Yeah.
1970s, 80s time period. So,
hey man, that wasn't that long ago. So, I mean, it wasn't that long ago.
But we didn't have internet or we didn't have big data, and people were doing research on natural language processing back then. So it is not a definitely not a revolution. It's an evolution. But what's changed is, so the first step we did was we did programmatic rules. Then we said, okay, let's take data and then start making rules for the data. But the early versions of machine learning was all about inferences and classification. Mm-hmm. So you infer an outcome saying that, hey, if I see this data, this likelihood, this is going to happen, right?
Yep.
Prediction,
yep,
and classification. That was the use case. What has evolved is now that can be taken further down into decision analysis or decision intelligence. Now you can actually make decisions like which is the best path forward. And when you have data and decision, now you can do automation.
Yeah.
So I think that is the big shift. And the history of computing, it's all about automation. And we tend to forget that, right? Everything is automation. Everything we do in computers is automation. Excel sheet is an automation, right? Mm-hmm. You put formula, it automatically calculates it.
Yep.
So when people think about AI automation, they see it in a very, very different lens. For me, it's no different than an automation you do in an Excel sheet. Mm-hmm. It's exactly fundamentally the same principle.
Yep.
The only difference is it can do automation of more higher level complex tasks, which cannot be defined by simple rules.
You know, I opened the podcast by talking about the fact that if you look at an enterprise company now, you do have options on how you get work done. Right. And, you know, we've gone through years of using software, which to your point had its own type of automation involved, and knowledge worker leveraging that software, but still a lot of grunt work involved in those interactions. Right. And now you can leverage AI, as you're describing, to make some of these decisions for you, to automate things. And, you know, one of the things that I know you'd like to talk about is this concept of ambient AI and how companies can leverage that. So put a little meat on the bone there. What is that concept?
When I think this is Arthur Clarke's quote, I believe, or maybe I'm paraphrasing it. He says, when a technology becomes so advanced, it's indistinguishable from magic.
Magic, yes.
Right. I think something to that extent.
Yep.
So a lot of technology that really, really works, we don't even realize it exists.
Mm-hmm.
We just take it for granted.
Yep.
I mean, if you look at the technology in your car, I mean, every modern car has inbuilt computers that calculates myriads of things. And we don't interact with them. We don't interface with them. Only thing you interact with them is your steering wheel and your accelerator. And even that is going away with autonomous driving, right?
Yeah.
So that is what is ambient AI or ambient technology is, right? It's running in the background. You don't even know it exists. It does all the work, hard work for you. And it takes care of things. That's the whole concept of ambient AI. Because a lot of times when people think about AI today, they're thinking about ChatGPT.
Yeah.
And ChatGPT is not Gen AI. It's not ambient because you're interacting with the system. It's a request response dialogue. Mm-hmm. You send a request, you get a response back.
Yep.
It's not running in the background and thinking about what does Krishna wants in his life next day.
Mm-hmm.
If you start doing that, that becomes ambient AI. So the stuff that we are working on in Support Logic, it's basically fundamentally an ambient AI that runs in the background, whether you have a chatbot or not, whether you're doing a specific thing or not. It runs in the background, looks at all your customer interactions ambiently, extract the signals, make the predictions, calculates the account health score, predicts who's the right subject matter expert in the company, identifies soft skill gaps. It does all the things autonomously in the background. without you having to have a dialogue interface with the system. That's what is an ambient AI is. The beautiful thing about ambient AI is that because it just dissolves and goes into the background and it runs, it continuously adds value. And the value is not disappearing. All the insights and everything it's generating is all stored back, which you can access later. You can access real time or you can access later. It's up to you how you want to use it. And it's non-disruptive because it's ambient. You're not changing workflows. You're not changing process. It's running in the background. It's doing its stuff. And it's almost like, I mean, again, I hate to use the word co-pilot because that's used in so many ways. It is a sort of a co-pilot because it's running in the background and doing all the tedious job you don't need to do manually. Yeah. And the data is there and you can work on that. So that's what it is.
So let me click into that. And you're right. Co-pilot is a loaded word because I think co-pilot now people are going to immediately think of interacting with a Gen AI type model, right? That's my co-pilot. I ask it a question. It gives me a response. But again, you're talking about AI doing things in a sense on your behalf. So let's click in, and you threw a couple examples out there quickly, but let's click into some of the use cases that you see powerful. So, you know, AI running and determining, hey, this particular case I know needs to go to this person and I will route it automatically as an example. But just put a couple of those on the table where you just see the most success with this technology.
So I'll give you an analogy and then I'll go to a real example of support as it's being used. Mm-hmm. The analogy you want to think about is assume that there is a device that you attach to your body. Let's say it samples your blood continuously, monitors your glucose level, your hormone levels. I don't know. Think about everything that you can monitor in the blood work, right? And it stores all the data, continuously measures and sees variances over time and everything, and then tells you, looks like you have a risk of this particular disease. That's going to happen in the future. And gives an early warning, right? That's a technology we see a lot of value. It's ambient. You're not interacting with it. It's actually running in the background, continuously measuring it and providing insights.
Looking for patterns and processing that. Yep, got it.
That's what we do for customer interactions. So your health of your customer, your health of your employees, your health of your business, it's there in the conversations you're having with your customers. So we tap into all those conversations and we extract the signals and we predict it. So what are things we actually predict on a real-life basis? A first and foremost early warning is basically escalations. If you have escalations and escalations continues to become a trend, escalation turns into customer churn or revenue churn. Even if the customer did not churn, you're going to have a down renewal or a flat renewal if not expanding. So there is a revenue impact, right? So predicting that early on and preventing it, it's very similar to if you're getting a heart attack, it's too late. You want to predict early signals of heart attack and act on your blood levels or your fat levels or whatever you need to improve. You go to a gym and you improve your performance. That's what we do for businesses, right? So escalation prediction is one. Second thing is a customer may interact with you in different channels at various point in time. And there may be multiple people in a company maybe interacting with you, right? So if you're talking to a large organization, it's not one person who's calling and interacting with your business. It's probably, I don't know, a couple of dozens of folks are interacting with you at any point in time. And they're interacting over a period of time and their customer relationship could be over the years. And they may call you, they may email you, they may have a voice conversation with you, they may have a chat conversation with you, they may talk to a human being, or they can talk to a chatbot. And all of this data can be fragmented into your telephony system, your ticketing system, your chat system, your data lake, and whatnot. So it's all fragmented, all these places. So we've basically federated into all of that conversations. And then we stitch the data saying that this particular account across all this channel, across all these interaction points, overall health looks like this. Overall, this is what the customer is looking like. That's something we provide today. So that's account intelligence or account health, right? And third part is also in the interactions, you can actually identify soft skill gaps. So if people are not saying the right things to your customers, they're setting expectations and not meeting expectations. They're not using the right language or grammar, all of that stuff. Common challenges in customer support. And I would say this is a common challenge in any post-sale customer interactions. We can spot that, we can identify that, and we can pinpoint the gaps. So that's another use case. You can also look at skill gaps. And when we say skill gaps, not just soft skill gaps, technical skill gaps. So you're interacting with this. These are technical skills required. Maybe this is the right person who can answer this customer question. Again, we can observe this from the interaction data. So the vision for support logic is always is that systems of record is what we used before. Now we are living in a streaming world. everything is conversational. We can actually build all these insights from the streaming data. You don't need to rely on going in a system of record to get that data, right? So that's the direction we're going, and that's the genesis of support logic as well.
So you put a lot on the table there, and I want to click into several concepts. So I'm going to start on escalation management and account health. So, you know, when you start to work with a customer, I'm super curious. You come in and you say, hey, I can start to look at all this information, some of it very unstructured, all these streams. I can look from, you know, multiple sources. But in terms of the markers of customer health, is that something that you work with the customer to figure out what are the markers for that particular company? Or do you see more universal markers? Do you see what I'm asking here? Because you got to tune that model to say, hey, this account is going to churn or this account's going to escalate. But how do you know that for that particular type of company?
A very simple approach. I mean, there's always, for anything, there's a preventable problem and a non-preventable problems. Mm-hmm. In escalations, I always say this, right? Some escalations are non-preventable. Your website is down, your service is down, customer's going to escalate. That's not something you can predict or prevent it, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, you can prevent it in other ways, but you can't necessarily predict it, right? Mm-hmm. But a lot of the escalations you're seeing is because of pure process lapses or pure lack of prioritization or pure lack of soft skills. That causes a lot of escalations. And our estimate, majority of the escalations are coming from that reason, not because of systemic issue. Same goes to churn as well. Some churn is non-preventable or predictable. Company goes out of business. You can't do anything about that churn, right? A company got acquired by a parent company, and parent company has a different software stack, and you don't need your software stack. That's non-predictable, preventable churn. Right. So that's something you can't do much about it. No point in predicting it. But a lot of other churn is predictable. So we focus on the predictable part of the churn. And those signals are buried in your conversations with your customers. The frustration builds over time. The unhappiness builds over time. The urgency builds over time. And those signal markers, if you can track that and you can track that over time, we can predict what the outcome is. And that's universal. That's what we do with support logic.
Yeah, so you answered my question. The fact that there are very common universal markers from company to company when you look at these interactions, so that you know, sort of jumpstarts the process here for you. When you come in, you can say, hey, I can put this model in place with these universal markers, and we're immediately going to be able to start to understand some escalations. By the way, as a side note, I can tell you from all the TSI members I talk to, it is a super hard renewal environment right now, and renewal propensity or risk, et cetera, that's a use case you guys definitely should be on, because a lot of people care about that now more than ever. The other thing I wanted to ask, because you're talking about bringing signals in from, you know, all these disparate channels. And I think, to me personally, well, actually anybody who's listening to this, think about an institution you worked with. I'll think about an interaction I had with my bank just 2 weeks ago, where you call into a call center, you work on a, you know, your issue, and then they say, oh, that's actually a different department. And you have that transfer and you literally hit the reset button, as you know. They have no idea what you talked about. You just got to start all over again. And God forbid they go, oh, that's actually not me. I have to send you to a third department. And I know from being a tech guy, they're all running different systems. They're all running blind to what the previous conversation was. So talk a little bit about how you help companies realistically stitch all that telemetry together from different channels, different systems. You know, what does that journey look like?
It stems from a rule-based mindset. I mean, we all had this telephony experience, press one for this, press two for this, press three for this. Mm-hmm. That's very expert system, rule-based approach.
Yeah.
Right. And that's when you'll start divvying up telephone lines and systems of records are different. You don't share data and you create all these complications. And for large enterprises, you also end up acquiring a lot of companies.
Yep.
So they have their own business processes and telephone lines and ticketing system. So they don't talk to each other, right? I mean, take large corporations like Sony or Microsoft or any of those guys, right? They do business in every sector you can imagine. You could buy a Sony television, you can have a PlayStation, and then you can have a Sony camera, and then all those things. And even the purchase order systems are separate. They're not centralized. So they don't even know, have a full picture of what this customer purchased from me. From across all these different product lines and everything, they don't even have that full picture. They're still struggling with that level of data integration. That's why we have master data management tools and all of that. So it gets further complicated when you're opening an issue with different product lines and you don't know the frustration of one product line, how that impacts the frustration of a different product line, right? So that's where architecturally where we did was from day one, we said, you know what, we're going to be system of record agnostic. Mm-hmm. We're going to connect to any system of record. Bring your own system of record, bring your own telephony channel, bring your own chat system, it could be disparate systems. We can federate and connect to it and we stitch the data from the customer's mm-hmm. trade-off, right? This yep. allows companies, large enterprises who have the siloed systems of record, they don't need to worry about this massive IT project of integrating it. They just federate within us and we provide that insights, unified insights across this channel. Yep. Yeah, it's really a real problem. I think this is a lot of the hype around AI ignores the data complexity issues. The ChatGPT is the world, you're interacting with ChatGPT, but ChatGPT has crawled through the entire World Wide Web for decades and has all the data. But private data in an organization is complex. Yeah. There is lots of complex.
Very siloed. It's very siloed. I mean, I can tell you from all the polling we've done on companies deploying any type of AI capability, you ask what are your biggest challenges? Almost every survey, every poll we do, the number one stumbling block is data. And it is either my data is not clean, my data is not connected, it's, you know, in all these different silos, I don't even know where my data is. But I'm going to put this on the table and just test the premise with you. I don't think that that problem cannot stand forever. And two things I think are emerging. Number one is what you guys are putting on the table is, you know, you're saying, look, we're going to acknowledge that current reality and solve for it. We're going to let you, you know, I don't care where your data is, you know, just point me in the right direction and I will bring it together so you don't have to go through this massive IT project of trying to rationalize all these systems. It's never going to happen. Never going to happen. I think the other thing that's happening, which you put on the table here, is that, okay, there's system of record data, that's fine, but there is a lot of interesting unstructured data that is in these interactions like, you know, customer calls, et cetera, which is just as valuable, maybe even more valuable for some of the signal liquidity that you can now start tapping into with this type of technology. And that becomes a game changer, right? Yeah. And so I think this problem is going to get solved.
Big breakthrough, right? I mean, I've spoken at TSIA, one of the keynote sessions many years ago. I said the same thing that 90% of the universe is made of dark matter and dark energy. Yeah. And the scientists, physicists have no clue of what dark matter and dark energy. All the research we have done is based on visible matter. That's mm-hmm. It's a very small fraction of the entire universe. Same goes to technology. 90% is dark matter and dark energy, which is your unstructured data.
Yeah.
Now the very first time we have the technology to process unstructured data. Mm-hmm. There's another analogy I wanted to say, which was, we're just talking to my CMO about this. Historically, right, we have to learn the computer language to interact with computers, mm-hmm. right? Whether it's Java or C programming or assembly language or punch cards or Python language, right? First time computers are learning the human language, right? So that fundamentally shifts how we're interacting with customers. So more and more stuff is going to be conversational, which means extracting intelligence from this conversation becomes extremely important more than ever because the number of conversations will only grow up. We already 90% is already conversational data. It's only going to grow up because interface itself is going to be conversational interface.
Yeah, for sure. So let's talk a little bit about, because again, Amy, the potential of the technology you're talking about, I think is massive for multiple use cases. But how do you see companies pointing to the ROI? They say, hey, if I deploy this, this is how I'm getting an ROI that's meaningful to me. What do they lock in on? What are some of the, you know, the core ROI metrics that move the needle?
Yeah, I think the way I usually say it to customers is there are three kinds of ROI you can think about. One is software consolidation, right? First of all, everybody wants to consolidate their software. Spend, right?
Right.
So if you look at a stack today, you have a survey software. Do you need surveys when you can extract customer sentiment from conversational intelligence, right? Mm-hmm. You have a separate software for routing tickets. You need that when you can use that from a conversational intelligence, right? Mm-hmm. So there's many myriads of software stack can be consolidated. Analytics, same thing. You can do analytics on unstructured data right now, so you don't need a traditional BI tool. Mm-hmm. So a lot of that can be consolidated. At least our licenses can be reduced. And so that's immediate ROI. You're going to get it. A lot of our customers love doing that. Oh, come in, I'm going to replace three different software and put one support logic instance, and I'm getting immediate ROI. Mm-hmm. Second ROI is reduction in escalations means frees up a lot of time. It's an 80-20 rule. 20% of your escalations take 80% of your time. So which means when you reduce escalation drastically, and we have lots of customer case studies where 50% to 80% reduction escalation is kind of pretty common for us. That's a significant reduction in customer escalation, which means you're spending time doing more productive stuff in the company. You need less managers managing stuff, right? All your density of your manager goes up. They can manage more people and more customers with fewer people. So you're going to get a lot of operational efficiency gains, right? Third one is more long-term impact, which is when escalation reduces, your brand experience goes up. Your CAC LTV drops quite a bit. When CAC drops, LTV goes up, right?
Yep.
So there is a big long-term benefit, which honestly, it's not been well studied in the industry. But you could argue that, I mean, we all know that acquiring customers is so expensive, losing customers is so easy. And if there is a way for us to keep customers happy, and you're reducing the customer acquisition cost, your existing customers or your marketing channel, that reduces CAC significantly, right? So those are three different levels. So immediate ROI is software consolidation. Efficiency gain is something you're going to see in 3 to 6 months time period. You're really going to see long term, you're going to improve your brand experience. That is immeasurable. And the fourth one I would add on top of that, Cherry, is that when you truly extract the voice of the customer, you identify new business opportunities and business risks that you never knew existed. They're all in your conversations. You're going to say, oh, I should go after this business line, or maybe this is a business risk for us. The market is changing. And that is a boardroom level conversation you can have with the other data.
So again, just all the people that I talk to right now in the industry, and as I listen to the levers there, I think that people getting hard savings on their tech spend and ultimately their headcount is super attractive and important to people right now. I think everybody is looking for those levers. And then the third one you're on, and I'll tell you a story. We had the CEO of a company that does a competitive analysis, AI-based competitive analysis, Clue, and he was telling a story, which I think like every software company has to hear. And that is, they have software that helps salespeople do competitive analysis. And he was telling me that, you know, they had one of their first and earliest customers, great customer. All of a sudden, the CEO gets notified they're not going to renew. And he couldn't believe it. So he goes and gets a meeting with the CFO of his customer and says, hey, you know, you guys have been great, you know, customers, what's going on? And the CFO said, hey, we're rationalizing our tech spend. And less than 20% of our salespeople are using your software. So, you know, it just is not making the cut. And he said, whoa. He goes, but have you seen the revenue generated and the hit rates of salespeople using our software versus not using, right? And once the CFO understood that, he's like, oh, I got it wrong. I got to get 100% of the salespeople to use it, right? So my point in that story is he could connect the dots between his software and real continued business impact. And I think that third use case you're on, you're saying, you know, it hasn't been studied that well. That's going to be the type of ROI ultimately that every customer is going to want from their software provider, saying, look, if I have Support Logic in and I now see my renewal rates go up, my renewal revenues go, you know, then you can start to track that for me over time. Then you are in a great position because you're like, I can't afford to pull that out. I just can't do that. And I think that's where the game is going to be played for anybody providing enterprise software, is really connecting to those types of value propositions. Does that make sense to you?
Totally, Thomas. We actually may do this with our customers. We actually show correlation of usage of our product and the KPI metrics impact. We see strong correlation between people using our product and their MTTR numbers, their mean time to resolution numbers, their escalation rates, their CSAT rates, their NPS score rates. So we can do cohort analysis on our product and we can do A-B comparison. In fact, one of the very first customers we closed, and this is before the AI hype, and they don't believe in AI at the time, right? This is 2018 time. Everybody was skeptical about AI. We did A-B analysis by having one support team, that was the test group, which was using our product, and the control group was the rest of the company, which was not using the product. And we measured and we show all the KPI metrics was improving, right? So scientifically, we can show that. Yeah, that's an important conversation that we have with our customers.
Yeah, for sure. And I think that's fantastic. And again, I think that's where the game has got to be played, because long are gone are the days where you could sell a theoretical ROI. Right. And then if the customer didn't get it a year later, you're like, oh, well, you already have the software, you already paid for it. Oh, well, it's just like those days are long gone. So I'm curious, since you guys are growing and you're working with more companies, what are some of the common mistakes you see companies make or things that they struggle with when they try to lean into technology like this? Where do they trip up or have self-inflicted wounds? What do you see there?
I think you probably heard this before. I'm probably not I'm the first one to say it. A lot of thinking and less action. So people think a lot.
Paralysis of analysis. They're thinking.
They're overcomplicating, overthinking. What about this? What about this? What about that? Right?
Yeah.
And you're going to learn a lot of this only by deploying it. And when you deploy, a lot of our customers discover value that never even thought they had these ideas in their mind and emerges from the tool, right?
Yeah.
So I think this is the challenge of a new category. I mean, we put ourselves into a new category. We are not a CRM category. We are not a telephony category. We are not a chatbot category. We're an intelligence category. We are helping you to be more smart and efficient and proactive.
Yeah.
So it takes people's mind to wrap up. So that's one thing I saw as a mistake. Second thing is also a common thing people say, oh, I don't think my data is clean.
Yeah.
I don't think my data has enough signals. And they'll be surprised that everybody thinks that. Everybody thinks that data is a snowflake. And we've seen so many snowflakes, right? And, and it's the complexity and the signals exist everywhere. And they are easily solvable problems.
Yeah.
So I think lean into it and give it a shot and give it a try. You'll be amazed and surprised. And then a lot of customers, once they use it, they realize, oh my God, how did I exist? How do I live without it?
Yeah.
It becomes second nature.
Yeah, I mean, and I'll just play that back and echo your sentiments. I mean, in part of our coaching to companies when it comes to deploying AI capabilities is you've got to start experimenting. You have to start getting battle scars around it because the use cases are so compelling. They really are. And like you said, people will be surprised. I mean, when you use technology like this, it's not like you say, well, I moved the needle 1 or 2 or 5% on something. You're moving at 10, 20, 30% on things that you care about. But you don't get that if you don't start. And I see this inverse relationship. The larger the company is, the less willing they are to experiment, right? The more they're like, oh, I can't do it. Like you said, I'm snowflake, you don't get it. You know, we're so complex. This, you know, the small to mid-sized companies are much more nimble on this, but the larger companies are going to find if they're not deploying this, like you said, you can't live without this stuff once you have it because it's such a game changer. And if you're not putting it in, you're creating handicaps for your ability to compete. And not 5 or 10 years from now, your ability to compete 2 years from now. And so I think, you know, there should be a sense of urgency out there that you've got to be experimenting. You can't have excuses of, I have a line, by the way, I use when, you know, we benchmark companies and they always start out by saying they're super unique and special. I say, you know, I'm going to tell you folks something I hope your mother never said to you. And that is, you're not special. You're special, but you're not. And it's hard for a lot of companies, you know, to internalize that.
Yeah.
But there's truth to it. Like you said, there's so many quote snowflakes out there. But I do want to ask this question because
Thomas, one point I want to insert there, which that's interesting. Actually, I go in depth about this in the book, and the whole chapter is dedicated about this. But one thing I want to say is also the opposite is also true. You talked about large companies being lethargic and they think they're special and everything. Small companies, on the other hand, think there is not enough value to be had in AI and they don't adopt AI. And I challenge that. And the reason is because when you adopt AI at a very, very early stage, even in a stage of like 5 support engineers or whatever it is, it becomes part and parcel of your culture. And the team coming on board, and there is value that can be attached to that cultural thing that you're imparting into the business is so immeasurable. I mean, we had a company like, we had one of our customers, Rubrik, adopted us when they're like, 6 or 7 or maybe 15 support engineers. And they went all the way through IPO, right, adopting it. And because it's part of the culture, that every team member, this is the only way they know how to do. Proactive support is the way they know how to do support.
Yep. Yeah, I mean that's a fantastic point because I believe very deeply that when these AI capabilities really eat through enterprise workflows, the way everyone is operating, I don't care if you're in support, your sales, your customer success, is going to be fundamentally different. It's just going to be way different how you're spending your days. And the sooner you get your employees into that culture, right? And like you said, really ingrained in, oh, this is the way we operate. This is standard, you know, like you said, why would we ever interact with customers without having this type of sentiment analysis and telemetry? That's like crazy. The sooner you get people into that posture, the better for you, and you know, for the company, for the employees and everybody else. So I really agree that sense of urgency is good on this stuff. You know, I do want to ask you though, because the AI genie is out of the bottle in a good way, in the sense that people now are aware of it, unlike they were, you know, 4 or 5 years ago. They're starting to get the sense that, okay, there are some use cases. So I think that this thing is going to tip fast in terms of, I don't think it's going to take like the internet or other technologies you and I have lived through, it's not going to take 5 or 10 years for AI to be really changing workflows. I'm curious what you're seeing, you know, on the front lines working with customers. How fast do you think this is going to move? And I'll just give you like a sense. So let's just say that I'll make it up. You know, 20% of support organizations have really mastered this type of, you know, sentiment analysis, et cetera. And it's probably less than that. Where do you think that number is, you know, 3 years from now? How fast do you think companies are going to lean into this capability since it is here? I mean, it's something you can do.
I think the pressure is definitely on for companies to adopt AI. It's a boardroom conversation. Everybody is to show to the boardroom what are they doing on the AI front for efficiency gains across all functional groups, right? Whether it's engineering, sales, or post-sales or support. So I think people are actively shopping and looking for tools. Yeah. And then the question is which tool to go after first. What's the foundational tool you have to invest in? I think to your earlier point about the adoption of technology, right? I mean, this is the trend we've always have seen. Internet took, I don't know, 15 years, 20 years to reach 100 million users. And then social media took much faster. Instagram took even faster. And ChatGPT adopted that in 2 months, 100 million users. Right. So progressive technology gets adopted faster, not because it's necessarily superior, because you have a massive distribution platform already in place. For ChatGPT to get adopted 100 million users, there is a billion phones out there.
Right.
There is internet out there. For everyone has access to internet. That's what makes the adoption of technology much, much faster. So I think that's only going to speed up as we go. Yep. And I think the companies are going to adopt AI much faster than they're going to think, or they're going to adopt ambient AI and they didn't even think they have AI in place.
Yeah. I don't want to go with that. I agree. I mean, it's, you know, all kind of flavors here are going to get incorporated into businesses. But yeah, I think it's going to tip fast. And again, I get nervous for any company that is still, like you said, the, you know, just thinking, debating, maybe. I think that posture is going to be a losing posture here very quickly. I'm watching the clock here. I have one final question I want to ask you. I was looking at your LinkedIn profile, and you already put this on the table earlier in the conversation, that you took this gap year before starting SupportLogic. And I find that interesting because I always mentor people when they're changing jobs, and I coach them, and I say, look, take some time off. It's the point in life where you're ending one job, you haven't started the next one. It's the best time to take, I don't care if you take 4 weeks or whatever, just take some time off. And nobody takes me up on that. Everybody's like, oh, I can't. I got to go into the next job, right? Missed opportunity. But you were, well, you had a great run at VMware and you took this year off. What did you learn by taking that year off?
I wanted a complete decompression. The thing is, we live in a bubble. When Silicon Valley, where I live in itself, it's a bubble, Silicon Valley bubble. But the company that you're working for is its own bubble.
Yeah.
So I spent 10 years in VMware and all I could think and eat and sleep was infrastructure. Right. Yep, and then I did this startup, Cloud Physics, which is also was in the infrastructure space. So my entire world and thinking was all about infrastructure. Mm-hmm. And I realized when I took the break, I realized the world is a much, much larger place. There's so many of the things that's happening in the world and our universe of infrastructure is very small. So when I was exploring for ideas, I actually was exploring all kinds of ideas for starting a company. I knew I wanted to start a company, but I wasn't in which space. So that's the one thing I learned. And second thing is that period was such an restorative period. It's so peaceful, calm. And I remember reading physical newspapers. And during that period, I would go to Starbucks and spend half a day in Starbucks. Yeah. But it got to a point where I was getting too comfortable with that. And that's when it really scared me. And I said, okay, I need to start a company. Because I was very comfortable just doing nothing.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, but it is really an important thing, right? Be able to take that break. When I worked at Silicon Graphics, they were one of the few companies that had a sabbatical program. And you got 6 weeks and you could put vacation on it. So basically people could take 2 to 3 months off. And I'm telling you, I saw people go on those breaks and come back and they were completely different people. Because as you know, it is a bubble. You're working in Silicon Valley, you're, you know, working at a particular tech company. There is just so much upside, if you can, to take a break. So my message to everybody listening, if you ever change jobs, follow what Krishna has just reinforced the fact there is a lot of upside. It, you know, kind of opens your aperture and then you end up doing the next great thing. So it's fantastic. Appreciate you sharing that. Well, thanks for stopping here. Good luck with the book. I'm sure it's going to do well. And I always end here with a question of the day. And my question to our audience today is, how long can you remain competitive if a majority of your workflows are still being executed by employees leveraging legacy enterprise software? Cheers, everybody.